The following content is meant purely for educational and informational purposes and should not be relied upon as financial, investment, legal, tax, or any other professional advice. This is the Fundamentals Podcast, where we demystify crypto and help you navigate this ever-evolving internet-native economy.
Hey, Ryan. Welcome to the Fundamentals Podcast. It is great to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Been looking forward to this. We have somewhat aligned missions, you know, onboarding people into Web3, and you guys at Bitwise have been somewhat of a pioneer in this space on certain fronts. So looking forward to diving into the details around everything that you do and your learnings from speaking with a lot of capital allocators and what the state of their understanding of the space is right now. So to set the stage before we dive in, could you maybe give a high-level introduction to what Bitwise is for anyone not yet familiar and what kind of the primary challenges are that you aim to address in crypto?
Yeah, definitely. We're big fans of Token Terminal at Bitwise. We love using you guys' product and so happy to be here and talk about this. Bitwise Asset Management is a crypto asset manager. We've been around since 2017. So we've been around for 7 years helping traditional investors like financial advisors, RIAs, hedge funds, pension funds, figure out how to allocate and get access to crypto in different types of products. So we have a suite of different crypto products. We work a lot with advisors and institutional investors on education, just helping them along their crypto journey and trying to write and produce content and hold webinars and educational conversations with them to help them understand why crypto is an important asset class, why it's here for the long term, and why they should be investing in it on behalf of clients.
That's awesome. Thank you for that compact intro. Now, 7 years, that's a long time. So you've seen the ups and downs in this space. And one thing that you guys are renowned for is being a pioneer somewhat in terms of crypto index funds. And you alluded to your broad product suite that you have. Could you maybe elaborate a little bit on your current product suite, what it consists of, and then what your approach is to index construction?
Absolutely. So we've been around since 2017. So we've been around for 7 years. We have about 20 products on the market today. Those are a wide range of products. We have funds that track indexes of crypto assets. And those are the top 10 crypto assets by market cap for the broad-based crypto sector. We have a DeFi focused index. We have an NFT focused index. So a lot of our funds just help investors gain passive exposure to crypto. And then we have a handful of single asset funds. Some of these are private placements. Some of these are OTC QX traded funds, kind of like GBTCS, where investors, if they want to allocate strictly to Bitcoin or Ethereum or Uniswap or Polygon, they can do that through private placement for accredited investors. We also have crypto equities funds, which invest in publicly traded crypto companies. So we have the Bitwise Innovators Index, which tracks companies like Coinbase and MicroStrategy and Bitcoin miners. So if investors just want to get exposure to the picks and shovels of crypto, as we call it, versus directly exposed to crypto assets, they can do that through crypto equities indexes. And then, of course, we have a big Bitcoin fund that just launched in 2011 with the other Bitcoin ETFs. That's over $2 billion in assets today and has been one of the most successful ETF launches of all time.
That's awesome. Really diverse product suite. And based on also my learnings from speaking to a lot of institutional investors and people who might not be the most crypto native, is everyone kind of feels like they want to get exposure to the asset class, but the way to do it isn't yet very clear. So I think one of your challenges is how you clearly communicate what these baskets consist of and why an investor should specifically get exposure to that specific asset, and also kind of tackle all of the concerns around crypto just being air or fluff. So I wanted to ask, related to that, how you assess which assets you consider investment grade that you then include in these baskets that you offer to investors. So what kind of criteria and frameworks do you use to do this analysis?
Yeah, that's a good question. And you're exactly right. We try to spend a lot of time helping investors who don't necessarily have time to think about crypto or spend a lot of time thinking about how they want to invest in crypto. We help them kind of sift through the noise and try to find those crypto assets that are really going to be here for the long term. If you take a step back and think about most of our clients and institutional investors as a whole, most of them maybe invest 1%, or more recently we're seeing 3% or 5% allocations to crypto in their broader portfolios. So if you think about the amount of time that they spend talking about crypto with their clients or thinking about crypto when they think about constructing their portfolio, it's a really small piece of their mind share. And so for that reason, with crypto being such a broad industry and there being so many crypto assets out there, they really need a crypto partner that can help sift through that noise, as you mentioned, and try to, you know, find products that are going to be here for a long time, build products that are going to be here for a long time, that have institutional kind of rules and methodologies and structures around them. So that for them, it's it's making an investment similar to investment they might make in equities or bonds or alternative investments, but they're just getting some exposure to crypto. And so that's what we spend a lot of time trying to do. It's pretty vanilla in a lot of circumstances. A lot of our funds, like our index funds, are just passive investment strategies. And so they follow an index methodology that is similar to the S&P 500, for example, where it's just going to track the top 10, or with crypto equities, the top 30 assets of a given sector. And over time, it's going to rebalance those assets on a monthly basis or a quarterly basis based on that methodology. And the methodology screens for a handful of things. Of course, market cap is the most important because these are market cap weighted indexes. That's why you'll see Bitcoin and Ethereum and Solana at the top of these indexes, because they're going to do the same thing that the S&P 500 is going to do, where they're going to allocate the most weighting to those assets with large market caps. But we also screen for other things that traditional indexes would screen for. So you can think of those as liquidity, right? How much volume and trading volume does this asset see on a daily or monthly basis? Can it be custodied by a regulated third-party custodian that's US-based, like Coinbase Custody or Anchorage or Gemini? That's another important factor and goes into our analysis on which crypto assets might be eligible to enter these funds. And then we look at other things like the actual security of the protocol. Has it been hacked? Has it been exploited? How does the infrastructure and the way that the coin or the blockchain functions, how does that impact the overall security of the asset? We think about regulatory risk. Is it at undue risk of being deemed a security by the SEC in the future? And then there's a handful of other kind of really nuanced eligibility requirements that we look at around governance and things like that. And so all of those things kind of go into this formula, call it, around what assets might enter a given index on a monthly or quarterly basis. And we kind of cut and copy and paste that same methodology across different sectors of crypto. So we have the Bitwise 10 large cap crypto index that tracks the top 10 crypto assets by market cap. You'll find things like Bitcoin and Ethereum and Solana and in Uniswap in that index. Then we have the DeFi index, which is the same exact methodology more or less, except for the fact that it focuses only on DeFi assets. And then you can kind of copy and paste that same methodology and apply it to the NFT sector, crypto equities, et cetera. And so depending on what area of the market these investors want to get exposure to and where they find most compelling, they can just kind of allocate to a strategy that follows this rules-based index and not have to worry so much that they're going to end up investing in something like Luna or FTX, for example.
Yeah, that's really great. And I like the fact internally you have a very risk mitigation first type of approach to putting these baskets together, because I feel that is the way that you get people to increase the portfolio allocations from 1% to 3% to 5% and start getting more mindshare when the approach is taken that way.
We are a really conservative firm. I'll just add that we have, generally speaking, been extremely conservative, and that can be frustrating sometimes in bull markets. I know in 2021, when in 2022, at the beginning of the 2022 annual year, when things were really starting to take off for certain assets, it was somewhat frustrating to some investors that we didn't have allocation to things like Luna, for example, when it was just absolutely skyrocketing. But I think that conservative approach has really played out well over the last few years and shows the fact that we've been around for many cycles. And even though we're going to be conservative and we're going to make sure that we're not allocating to things like Luna or FTX, which we've never had exposure to in any of our funds, we are going to, miss some of that upside in bull markets for that reason on some of those assets. But what we're really trying to do is protect investors to the downside and provide them long risk-adjusted exposure to the space. And so it's important to be conservative, even though that might hurt a little bit in bull markets, it hurts far less in bear markets.
Yep, 100%. It's always the kind of balancing between long-term versus short-term thinking. And the short-term gains can be pretty blinding in this space. So it takes some strong-mindedness to focus on the long-term. Now, you mentioned that the mindshare that crypto has is not that large yet. So looking for very passive vehicles that they could invest into and get exposure to the asset class. I want to dive a bit deeper into that in the sense of, from your perspective, how would you describe the current state of institutional interest for that limited amount of mind share towards crypto as an asset class? Is it just wanting exposure, caring about market cap weightings, or are they also trying to peek a bit more under the hood, look at some more specific like fundamentals focused metrics, or is there anything else there that you might want to highlight?
Yeah, I think it's mixed is the answer there. It really depends on the firm you're talking to, maybe the size of the portfolios that they manage and what their clients are asking about. For the most part, we're still really, really early when it comes to institutional investors and financial advisors thinking about and investing in crypto assets. And for that reason, a lot of them are just trying to get up to speed because they're seeing Bitcoin and crypto in the headlines everywhere. They're realizing this isn't just a Ponzi scheme, right? Which is what I hear a lot of investors saying when they first kind of get into the space, which obviously we don't believe is true, but you have to walk people through that journey and get them to the other side of the spectrum on that thought process before they'll even consider allocating to crypto on behalf of their clients. And so generally what I see is that in a lot of firms that we talk to, there might be like one or two people in the firm that are deeply into crypto on a personal level. They may be big believers in Bitcoin. They may be trading NFTs. They may just believe in the long-term trajectory of the sector. And what they're trying to do is fight the good fight for their clients and their portfolios and talk to maybe the higher ups at the firms or the other people across the investment committee at the firm to try to get them to the point where they feel comfortable investing in crypto for their clients. Generally speaking, those that get there are allocating maybe 1% to 3% of crypto to their portfolio. Those that are a little bit more down their crypto journey are allocating anywhere from 3% to 5%. And I've had conversations with some financial advisors who maybe have a younger clientele that's more made their money in tech or something like that. They could be allocating 10% to crypto because they feel more comfortable with that. But generally speaking, it's a smaller allocation than most of us in crypto would have to the industry. I know personally, it's much more than 5 or 10%. But when we talk to advisors, that's really all they can stomach. And a lot of them are just looking at Bitcoin today. And I think once they get their toe in the water with Bitcoin, they'll kind of see the light and start to expand beyond that. I certainly get asked about Ethereum and a lot this past, you know, I'd call it 6 months about Solana. And I was at a conference last week where I was being asked about meme coins because one of these advisors had a son who's like trading meme coins they find on Instagram. So like you go down the funnel a little bit depending on who you're talking to. But for the most part, it's broadly the top three or maybe five crypto assets that people are asking about. But every once in a while, we get asked about NFTs or DeFi or meme coins.
Yep. That is really fascinating data points there. And I know that from kind of a crypto native person's perspective and living in the crypto Twitter trenches, 5% sounds like very small. But you do need to understand for an emerging asset class that is as volatile as it is, it's actually a very big step to have people include that into their portfolios, even though, like personally, if my exposure would be closer to 100%, I would have that 5% in purely meme coins, which raises my like own risk profile through the roof. But you get used to it.
Exactly. So as a financial advisor, your entire business is really about around building your book of business. So you're going out and trying to find clients who are going to entrust you with managing their assets. And for the most part, those clients, they aren't used to, obviously, outside of the crypto world, years where they see 400, 500, 600% gains. And so for them, a 5%, an 8%, a 10% gain is great. What they're really trying to do is protect their assets to the downside, right? They're trying to preserve their wealth. And so if you think about an advisor who's trying to do well for their clients from that perspective, then a 5% allocation, if it were to go to zero, or worst case scenario, crypto blows up, Bitcoin goes to zero, they've only lost 5% of their portfolio. It's a big chunk, but it's not unmanageable. It's not, you know, you can recover from that. Anything more than that, they might be at risk of losing that client's business, which they obviously don't want to do. And so that's where you start to see the 1% or 3% kind of space really take hold is when they're like, look, what's the worst case scenario? What if crypto really does blow up and go to zero? Can we afford to lose 1%? Can we afford to lose 3%? And can we recover from that? And generally speaking, the answer to that is yes, you can recover from a 1% or 3% loss. The S&P 500 or the NASDAQ sometimes falls 1% to 3% any given day. So really, that's not as tough to stomach as a 5% or a 10% loss.
Exactly. That's a really good and valuable perspective that you brought up that I think a lot of people miss in that discussion. But yeah. Now, you mentioned that the initial interest is pretty often focused on Bitcoin. And obviously, through the Bitcoin ETFs now, we have a lot of new interest than just passive allocations to that asset. But you also mentioned that investors are starting to ask more about like Ethereum and Solana. So I wanted to ask your perspective about how your current investors and how you internally are thinking about the differences of Bitcoin and Ethereum as investment assets, both in terms of how you think of them, but also how you communicate it to clients, because this is where the nuances of how Bitcoin is a pretty simple asset in itself. And the store of value narrative is easy to grasp, but then Ethereum is a very multi-dimensional, multifaceted asset that can be pitched from very different perspectives. You know, both protocols basically generate cash flows, but in the case of Bitcoin, everything goes directly to miners, not benefiting passive holders in any way, in comparison to like Ethereum, which arguably is a much more productive asset, as both stakers and passive holders can earn fee income through direct rewards and then also the burn mechanism built in there. So how do you kind of distinguish between these two when you're trying to describe the difference between the assets to investors and advisors?
Yeah, you know, it's tough to spend an hour or maybe an hour and a half, which is what we have with these advisors when we're having these conversations, and get through everything that Bitcoin is and where it belongs in a portfolio, and then everything that Ethereum is and where it belongs in a portfolio and the different nuances about them. But we do get a lot of investors asking about the differences between different crypto assets. And Bitcoin and Ethereum are great examples of two very different crypto assets that, as you mentioned, have very different kind of value accrual mechanisms and really sit in a different part of a portfolio for most investors. So we think about it in terms of portfolio construction and different sleeves of where investors might want to make these allocations. So Bitcoin, it's a great digital store of value. A lot of traditional investors maybe have an inflation sleeve of their portfolio. That might be, or an inflation hedge sleeve of their portfolio. They might be investing in gold there, or as we like to advise, investing in Bitcoin, right? So they might think of Bitcoin as a digital gold. That's a really easy model that obviously the industry has been pushing for a long time, but really is easy to understand. Limited supply, digital store of value, growing demand through, you know, increased adoption and ETFs, which unlock a bunch of demand, limited and falling supply through the halving. Those are kind of real tangible supply and demand dynamics that we can talk to investors about. And they think of Bitcoin more as an inflation hedge or a digital version of gold. And that makes a lot of sense. Then you have Ethereum, which is very different, obviously. And we talk about that in the sense of belonging in your technology sleeve. So if you are going to invest in a technology index like the NASDAQ or technology companies like the FANG companies, then maybe you should invest a little bit of that in Ethereum, because really this is the technology platform for the future of crypto applications. And obviously that can apply to Solana and other layer one blockchains that are smart contract enabled and we're seeing applications be built on. But we like to use Bitcoin and Ethereum as the two examples. And so we talk about Ethereum kind of from that perspective. Like, look, if you think we're living in an increasingly digital world, which we have been for the past 50, 100 years, then it's very likely that if you look forward 20, 30 years, crypto and blockchains are going to be a big part of everyday life. And for that reason, maybe in the technology sleeve of your portfolio, you want to have some exposure to Ethereum, which is likely to be one of the big technology platforms for crypto applications and blockchains going forward into the future. And then we talk about those cash flow dynamics that you mentioned. And so when we think, once we get them comfortable with the concept of Ethereum as a technology platform and belonging in the technology sleeve of a portfolio, we start to talk to them about there's different ways that that value accrues to Ethereum holders. So you have the buyback through the burn mechanism, really. And what I mean by that is most investors are used to the concept of a stock buyback, right? A company taking its excess profits, buying some of the stock, which creates more demand on the stock price, also reduces the circulating supply. That's kind of what happens with Ethereum. If you think about the burn mechanism, right? There's supply being taken off the market. That should increase the demand to supply ratio. And then we talk about staking rewards, right? If they're going to stake their Ethereum, then you can earn some yield, which is kind of like a dividend, right? It's like the excess profit that the network is kicking off to investors or holders of ETH. And so when they start to hear those dynamics combined with the thought of this is a technology platform for the future, it has a built-in share buyback strategy, it has a built-in dividend yield strategy. Those three things combined really start to look like an attractive investment for, you know, a tech sleeve of a portfolio.
I have to say, that was a really great overview. It's quite obvious that you spend a lot of time educating investors about this way, because that step-by-step approach and first grasping that is a technology platform and then just understanding that function of Ethereum as an asset and then getting into the more nuanced technicalities of how the economic model works of the asset itself. I think that's a really great approach to get investors interested. Now, if we think about those two sleeves, you have the inflation hedge, which Bitcoin falls into pretty nicely, and then you have these tech investments. This is a bit of a speculative question, but given the talk around a potential Ethereum ETF, based on like your discussions, how do you see the interest for something like that comparing to the interest we've been seeing for the Bitcoin ETF? Will it be harder to approach for investors right now, or do you feel that would be something that has even more mass interest?
I think it'll be harder to approach for investors. My kind of my honest take on this is that I think that if we got Ethereum ETFs this year, they'll have far less interest than if we were to get them in 2 or 3 years from now. And obviously, you know, as a crypto asset manager, we're really bullish on the outlook for these asset classes, and we would love investors to be able to access them sooner rather than later so they don't miss some of that upside. But I think the honest truth around where we see client and investor demand today and where we see their education of crypto as a whole, they just aren't there with Ethereum. Often I'm having conversations that are, what is Bitcoin? What is a blockchain? You know, what does it mean to have a limited supply? What does it mean that, what is the halving, right? And so they're like very early in their crypto journey. And so for most investors today, they're just getting over that hump of saying, okay, Bitcoin is a legitimate asset. It's now a $1.5 trillion asset that institutions like Fidelity and BlackRock are adding to model portfolios and are putting their, you know, kind of putting their power behind. And for that reason, we can start to consider Bitcoin in our portfolio. We can start to learn about Bitcoin. But then you introduce this thing like Ethereum, which we talked about as a technology platform where these burn mechanism and these staking, like these are all new concepts that are just quite honestly difficult to understand for people that haven't been in it for months and years. And so I think if we had an Ethereum ETF launched in May, which is that next final decision deadline for the SEC, we're just not going to be able to get investors there that quickly. Many of these platforms are just considering investing in Bitcoin, or they haven't even been approved to invest in Bitcoin. So then to think about throwing Ethereum into the mix, really, I just don't think we'll see the demand there. But if you wait a year or 2 years, and then we have this normalization of Bitcoin in a portfolio, the widespread adoption of Bitcoin across different platforms that investors use, that financial advisors use, then you introduce Ethereum ETFs. I think we see a lot more demand for the second largest crypto asset at that point than we would this year.
That is a very important point. And I have to say that I think I haven't heard that be said out loud yet in any place. So I'm glad you did bring it up, because you do need to be honest. And especially when you are on a day-to-day basis educating investors, you have a really good view into how far they currently are from really understanding the longer tail of assets, like, and not even the long tail, but just outside of Bitcoin. So I would tend to agree with you that that could be a very potential outcome if the ETF were to be approved pretty quickly. On the education side of things, in addition to having one-on-one discussions, you know, walking people through these concepts and onboarding them to the space, do you have any more like concrete high-level initiatives that you are undertaking to educate investors and advisors about crypto assets, like on a day-to-day basis? What are you guys at Bitwise doing to help the investors get to a stage where in 2 years they would be very ready to pull the trigger on something like an Ethereum allocation?
Yeah, I mean, it really is a long journey. So we're really partnering with investors over that 2, 3, 5 year journey. And so we spend almost every single day in one way or another educating investors. A lot of what I do on the research team at Bitwise revolves around educating investors. And so we do that in a few ways. A lot of the content that we put out, whether it's CIO memos from Matt Hogan, our CIO, or whether it's different pieces around Bitcoin or Ethereum, or, you know, what we would call white papers, which are far less technical than the white papers that we see across the crypto industry generally. These are more, you know, educational pieces on how to think about Bitcoin as an asset, how to think about allocating to Bitcoin in a portfolio, what is the halving, what is Bitcoin mining. These are all kind of very simple educational pieces that we try to put into 1-2 page formats that are easy for investors to understand. And then we have a sales team of about 25 people that go around the country every single day. And they're kind of split regionally like a traditional asset management distribution team would be. And they're going into clients' offices, and they're going into branches of different advisory firms, and just having lunch and learns, essentially, and talking to advisors about crypto, answering any question they may have, whether from, you know, why is this thing not a scam, to how do I go and mint an NFT? It's really this like really wide spectrum that we're going and addressing. On the research team, we often join our sales team in those meetings to help answer some of those more detailed questions around the networks and the tokenomics and things like that. But a lot of what we do is educational based. We host a lot of webinars, which, you know, is kind of funny, I think, to the crypto community to hear that, because, you know, I don't know the last time one of us like tuned in for a webinar on a certain topic. But if you think about financial advisors and institutional investors, a lot of them have certain, you know, licenses that they have to go through continued education to maintain those licenses. And so we work with platforms like RIA Channel and like DACFP, which is a digital asset certified financial planning platform, to host these webinars where we're talking about different topics, whether it's a crypto market update, or we just hosted one earlier this week on the halving and Bitcoin mining and how that impacts Bitcoin's tokenomics, how that impacts Bitcoin miners. And advisors can come in and they can join these webinars. They go for an hour long. They can kind of get these presentations. They can earn their continued education credits, which is a legal requirement for them to continue managing money. And so we're kind of meeting them where they consume their content is what I would say. Easy to digest, one pagers, webinars where they have to go through these accreditations every single year anyway. So why not meet them there with some crypto content? And then we go to a lot of traditional finance conferences. Our team constantly is at different institutional conferences, whether those are Barron's conferences or ETF conferences, or I was just at a private wealth forum last week meeting with family offices and private equity firms and ultra high net worth individuals. And so we spend a lot of time educating, I would say.
Yeah. And that's what the approach needs to be like. I mean, crypto is pretty much focused around Twitter. And we've noticed that at Token Terminal as well. You know, if you're just putting your stuff out on Twitter, you're shouting into an echo chamber and everybody is like crypto native there and you're not reaching the audience that we should be reaching and that we should be onboarding. And webinars, we just noticed that last week I was a guest on a Bloomberg webinar speaking about on-chain data. And we directly noticed the impact. The audience that we reach through that is so incredibly different, and the level of interest that you get there, it's the correct audience that we should be talking to as of right now to get new capital allocators interested in this space so that they can learn to ask the right questions and start diving deeper. So it sounds like that approach is incredibly efficient. So glad to hear you're taking that route.
I think, look, it brings a lot of legitimacy to the space when you have a crypto company like Token Terminal joining a webinar by Bloomberg, which is the go-to, you know, trading platform and data provider for majority of professional investors. And so when you have someone like Bloomberg, who's a very legitimate, very well-known, very influential kind of investor platform, bringing Token Terminal into the discussion and dedicating time and resources to cover crypto and how to get on-chain data from crypto, I think that really adds a stamp of legitimacy to crypto as a whole that the industry really needs to get from this kind of early stage to mass adoption part of its journey. And so I think that's really great and love that you guys are doing that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Thank you. It was great. Like a milestone, I feel, for us, but also for the industry in some way. And hopefully, I mean, it definitely feels like a lot of Bloomberg's clients are getting more and more interested in crypto data. And they have a lot of companies in their portfolio right now that are launching on-chain business lines. So even though they might not necessarily have any type of crypto focus at a fund level, but their portfolio might require them to start digging into on-chain data and understanding what's happening in this space. And kind of related to that, I wanted to expand on the education question, the data-specific question, and understand a bit better how you at Bitwise utilize tools like Token Terminal or on-chain data in general to help explain the industry to investors. What kind of role does that play?
Yeah, I mean, we use Token Terminal widely at Bitwise. And I would say a lot of the data that we're pulling and kind of rolling up into our reports is sector level data. And we're trying to use traditional metrics that investors understand, like revenue and monthly active users and kind of core metrics like that and KPIs, rather than the on-chain movement of certain tokens, for example, that you might get with some other data platforms. And so we put out a quarterly crypto review that goes out every quarter. We use Token Terminal and a lot of on-chain data across that report. And there's a similar report in TradFi called the JP Morgan Guide to the Markets report. It's a really well-known report that the JP Morgan team puts out. And so what we set out to do was create a crypto version of that report that speaks to things like revenue, active users, number of applications, DEX trading volume, and the amount of Ethereum stake, the number of validators on Ethereum, the performance of the top 10 assets in different sectors of crypto, correlations to traditional assets. These are all kind of the metrics that we tend to use that speak to advisors. Because when you start talking about even concepts like TVL, like that's not a term that a traditional investor has ever heard before. Now you can rephrase it and talk about capital deployed or assets under management, which then they can start to understand. So I would say we take the on-chain data that Token Terminal does a really good job of packaging into traditional metrics, and we just roll that up at a very high level and look at it kind of by sector or as an industry as a whole, rather than at individual assets or projects.
Yeah, and that's something that we're very, very much aligned on. We do believe that the standardization and financialization of these metrics is so important for investors to be able to come in and see metrics that they're familiar with methodologies that are almost one-to-one comparable with what they're used to, instead of having to dive directly into trending contracts and trying to analyze what's happening on a very granular block by block level, because that's not necessary. I mean, a very little amount of investors actually stare at, say, credit card merchant data, like the alternative data sets that are available. But you would much rather focus on like the quarterly cadence of financial statement line items. So we want to provide that through Token Terminal. So it makes a lot of sense what you say. It, again, makes things more easily approachable. And that's what everything needs to be.
Yeah, exactly. If you think about an advisor who spends their summers golfing and going to conferences and wine and dining clients, they don't have any interest really in understanding what ZK proofs are or what proof of stakes are or what the difference between one L2 is versus another L2 when it comes to optimistic rollups or bridging assets. What they do know and what they really appreciate are traditional metrics like revenue, profit, price to earnings, price to sales, active users, earnings, things like you can see in quarterly financial statements. And when you start to talk in that language and meet them where they're used to analyzing investments and thinking about investments, that's when you really start to see the light bulb turn on.
Yep, 100%. You need to kind of abstract the technicality and kind of get to what the actual use cases are from a consumer's perspective, right? And diving or pivoting into that topic a little bit, I know it's top of mind for you right now. I would love to speak a little bit more about how you Bitwise are looking at the current crypto use cases. You put out a paper about that very recently. So could you maybe walk me through your thinking about the current most interesting use cases for crypto and how you see that developing going forward?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the questions that we often get when we're talking to investors and financial advisors about crypto is, what are the real use cases? Is this just a speculative asset class where you're going and you're buying tokens and hoping they go up? Or are there real world use cases having a real impact across the world? And so what we set out to do last year, and now we've decided to do every year annually, is write a paper that covers some of the most compelling use cases that have adoption across the world that aren't your traditional kind of crypto investments or crypto use cases that the mainstream media covers. So we're really excited about the different breakthrough technologies and breakthrough applications that we're seeing across crypto. A lot of that's enabled by lower cost transactions and lower cost networks like Solana, or now with L2s and post EIP 4844, we have significantly lower transactions on Ethereum L2s. And so for that reason, we're starting to see really interesting use cases pop up all over the world. And so some of the ones that we covered this year in our paper, which I'm really excited about, aren't even necessarily things you would consider crypto a part of as an outsider, but obviously us in the industry are very aware of. And so Farcaster is a great example of a real world use case for crypto, where you have this decentralized social media platform that on the back end is using blockchains for data storage and for ownership of your profile and your followers and your content. But on the front end, looks like Twitter or looks like a social media platform that we're used to using as regular consumers across the social media industry. So Farcaster is a really interesting one. You can look at metrics there, like monthly active users, for example, to kind of compare that to a traditional social network, where that's generally the core metric on something like Facebook or Instagram or TikTok. It's going to be monthly active users. And so, again, you start to meet investors with metrics that they're used to thinking about. And it's really impressive when you look at Farcaster and see that last month they had 150,000 monthly active users across the platform. Now, that seems really small compared to like Facebook. But if you look at that chart and you look at it over a trend, which is why this data is so important, you can see that that skyrocketed from about 5,000 monthly active users a year ago. And that growth and that trajectory kind of shows that this use case of decentralized social media and Farcaster is really starting to take hold and seeing growth. Another use case that we're really excited about in general is the tokenization of real world assets. And so that's more in the financial realm, obviously, for crypto. But that's one thing that crypto does really well with DeFi, is that it removes intermediaries and it makes opaque and slow transactions and costly transactions more efficient and more transparent. And we're seeing that happen with like Ondo Finance and Superstate, which are bringing real world assets on chain through tokenization. And so you start to show investors and advisors that, look, there's hundreds of millions of dollars in these on-chain products. And by the way, it's not just crypto companies. It's also platforms like Franklin Templeton. And as we saw this week, BlackRock's launching an on-chain tokenized fund that gives investors in the crypto world exposure to treasuries and other kind of real-world assets in a format that they're used to, right? Taking those real-world assets and wrapping them in a token in the same way that traditional funds take assets and wrap them in an ETF or another structured product. And so tokenization of real-world assets is another one. I'll just throw one more out there that we were really excited about and I think is growing growing across the crypto industry, the excitement around this is prediction markets. So Polymarket has seen an absolute, you know, skyrocket of user activity over the past few months. And I think we're only going to see that activity continue to grow this year because we're going into an election year. I think that's a really interesting use case for crypto because prediction markets have existed for years. They've been around for a really long time, but they haven't been legal in the US, and they have generally been these offshore entities that, you know, can or can't be sketchy. But in the same way that some people might be hesitant to use an offshore exchange, a lot of people are hesitant to use an offshore prediction market. And so what crypto allows is that it removes the required trust of a prediction market platform, and you just rely on smart contracts and crypto to handle the payouts and the gathering of assets and ensuring that the bettors on both sides of the trade or the bet have the requisite funds. And then once that bet transpires, it just automatically directs the payouts. And that just removes the need to trust some CD offshore prediction market. And we're seeing that grow tremendously in the past year, in the past few months. I think, given the giant spike we've seen in online betting for sports, and given the continued interest we've seen in like real polling data that's not manipulated by the mainstream media, prediction markets are like at a really, really interesting intersection right now, where I think they're going to become more and more prevalent in this election cycle for telling where people really, or what people really believe is going to happen. It's kind of a put your money where your mouth is type of platform. And I think that is really, really important, and seeing a lot of interest and adoption right now that, the industry wasn't ready for a couple of years ago, but now is.
Those are some great use cases. And I feel that all three of those have the potential to really tap into broadening the user base of crypto, as long as the technicality is abstracted from that, because all of them are verticals where, if done correctly, the end user might not even realize they're operating on blockchain rails or they're transacting on blockchain rails in any sense. So I like all three of those. And tokenization is one which, of course, Larry Fink has been name dropping a lot in a lot of interviews. So many investors who have never heard of it before are starting to wonder, okay, maybe I should look into what all of that is about. So interesting things to come there as well. I did want to ask that as you put together these reports now on a yearly cadence, you do some pretty extensive research to try to understand what the current trends are, what could be trends to start taking off in the kind of mid to long term. Do you use this as a stepping stone to then start potentially thinking of what kind of new products you could develop at Bitwise? Or is it more of like for educational purposes, purely to gauge investor interest and get them attracted to this asset class, or a bit of a combination of both?
I think it's mostly, to pique interest in the industry and kind of show that there's more going on under the surface than most people would expect. And so we do obviously want to stay educated internally at Bitwise on the happenings in the space in case there's an opportunity for us to launch a product that would give investors, exposure to something that's really exciting and has a lot of growth potential. But for the most part, we're generally just diving into this stuff to make sure that we can communicate to investors that there's more to crypto than meme coins or than price speculation. This really is a technology that's going to fundamentally change the way that we interact with each other, that businesses interact with customers, and that data is stored and shared and verified. And that's becoming increasingly important in an increasingly digital world. And so really what we're trying to do is just communicate that to investors and make sure that we're showcasing the different sectors of the economy, whether it's social media or tokenization of assets or gambling or prediction markets. There's all these different interesting corners of the global economy that crypto has the ability as technology to disrupt and enhance and improve. And so that's what we're trying to communicate to investors when we do these deep dives.
That is exactly the message that we need to be pushing through all of the noise to get people to take this seriously. So I'm glad we have folks like yourself and the broader team at Bitwise pushing this message forward. It's really great to see. And I have one final question to start wrapping this up. This has been a great session related to another paper or article that you put out recently, which was very great. I had fun reading it now a few months into 2024 because it was titled "The Year Ahead, 10 Crypto Predictions for 2024. They were very well thought out predictions. So good job on that. I was wondering if you could just briefly walk through what these predictions were and how they are looking now that we're about 3 months into the year.
Yeah, certainly. This was a really fun project to put together. We kind of went across the different areas of the team at Bitwise, whether it's our more active strategies and kind of hedge fund team, whether it's our executives and our sales group that's going out and talking to investors, and then across the research team. And we wanted to kind of gather the hive mind and see like, what are the some consensus, and then what are some non-consensus predictions for 2024, and put those out there. And what I think was most interesting putting this paper together was the level of disagreement we had on so many of these predictions across the firm, which was a really fun exercise to go through. Yeah, so we put out 10 predictions with one bonus prediction, so a total of 11 predictions, and I'll kind of run through each of those real quick, and maybe we can do like a report card on each, which could be fun to do. The first prediction was that Bitcoin will trade above 80,000, setting a new all-time high in 2024. Now, we haven't quite hit this one, right? Obviously, we kind of breached all-time highs within the last 30 days, but we've settled down and kind of chopped sideways from there. Our thinking behind this prediction was that Bitcoin isn't just going to settle to touching new all-time highs and then fall back down to levels that we've, you know, historically been used to, that we're going to touch new all-time highs. And then at some point, we're going to really break through and see at least a 15% kind of increase in this price over previous all-time highs. So yes, we've set new all-time highs, but just barely, and we haven't quite hit the 80K level. There's definitely been talks internally about increasing this price target now that we've seen such strong traction of Bitcoin ETFs and such an increase in demand for Bitcoin and an increased interest in the space this year. But right now, this one, I would give it maybe a B, because we have hit all-time highs, but we haven't hit that 80,000 level. The second prediction was that spot Bitcoin ETFs will be approved, and collectively, they'll be the most successful ETF launch of all time. This came out in, I believe it was November, maybe it was the beginning of December. So ETFs hadn't been approved yet, but there was a high likelihood that they were going to be approved. I think the Bloomberg analysts that were covering ETFs had their odds at around 90% when we put this out. So this one, we're happy to have gotten this right. We're happy that Bitwise was one of those companies that launched Bitcoin ETFs in January. And collectively, they have been the most successful ETF launches of all time. Four of the Bitcoin ETFs are in the top 25 of ETFs when it comes to assets gathered in the first 30 and 50 days. Now, ETFs have been around for 30 years. They've been around since the mid-90s. So the fact that we've had Bitcoin ETFs launch in 2024 in January, and we're already setting records come March, is really, really, really fascinating and really great. And, you know, obviously something that I think the industry should be really proud of. And it shows that we're here to stay, and that Bitcoin and crypto really is this David and Goliath story. And I think that in the long run, crypto will win. And this was kind of us planting our flag in the ground for the first time with this, you know, call it Bitcoin's IPO moment with spot Bitcoin ETFs. So I'd give that one an A, because I think we nailed that one and are really happy with the success of the Bitcoin ETFs. I think we surprised Wall Street, to be honest. There was a lot of people calling for Bitcoin ETFs to be a flop and said there wouldn't be much interest in Bitcoin ETFs. And I think the ability to allocate to Bitcoin in two clicks of a button through a ETF format, which investors are used to and can now access in retirement accounts and across different stock and brokerage accounts, I think it's really, really valuable. And we're doing it in a very low cost way that's less expensive than the way it was, than the traditional methods of investing in Bitcoin through centralized exchange. You know, these are charging 20 basis points, 25, 30 basis points on your investment versus 1% or 2%, which is a very big difference. And so I think we really, you know, surprised Wall Street with the success of the Bitcoin ETFs. The third prediction here was Coinbase's revenue would double and that we would crush Wall Street's expectations by at least 10x. The most interesting thing about this prediction to me was just how misunderstood Coinbase's business model is by the analysts that cover it on Wall Street. I mean, Coinbase is a juggernaut. They have their, you know, tentacles in every corner of the crypto world, from layer twos to stable coins to derivatives to spot trading. I mean, to Coinbase Ventures, which is a venture company under the Coinbase umbrella that's made hundreds and hundreds of investments over the years in some of the top performing crypto projects. And so when you have that picture, and then you kind of put that against the backdrop of Wall Street expecting that their revenues would be flat year over year, it just doesn't make any sense. So when we pulled the data here, we saw that Wall Street was expecting 2024 revenue of Coinbase to be in line with 2023 revenue. And I'm pretty sure this one's going to blow out of the water, because we've already seen a huge spike in trading volume in 2024. That's where a lot of their revenue comes from. Plus, they're earning fees from being the custody of these Bitcoin ETFs. Plus, in general, in bull markets, Coinbase tends to do very, very well. So I think that the revenues will double and crush Wall Street's expectations. Let's say that.
Yeah, I agree. The trajectory is pretty crazy. Also with ETH staking, the growth there, and the base blockchain, which right now is just going parabolic. So you never know how big of a business line that's going to grow into, too.
Very true. Very true. I think people discounted how much revenue that Coinbase will ultimately generate from base. And we're starting to see with the adoption that you referenced that they've seen this year, that start to, you know, account for a meaningful amount of revenue in their P&L. So Coinbase is a company I remain bullish on, and I think is really well suited for the long term when it comes to, you know, a crypto stalwart. Prediction number four was that more money would settle using stablecoins than using Visa in 2024. So this was another interesting thing that when I took a step back and looked at the data of stablecoin transactions. So these are like sending stablecoins from one person to another or making payments for goods and services using stablecoins. Not, this doesn't include like trading Ethereum for USDC or something. This is strictly using stablecoins for settling transactions. And payments and for goods and services. And then you compare that to Visa, which is a, you know, global payments company that settles trillions of dollars in payment volume every single year. I expected stablecoins to be, you know, much smaller than it was in comparison to Visa. I think in 2023, it was about 60% of Visa when it comes to stablecoin transactions. So Visa settled, I want to say, around 12 trillion in payment volume in 2023. And I think stablecoin settled somewhere around like 7 trillion in 2023, maybe 8 trillion. And so we believe that this year, with the boom of the crypto market, we could see more money settle using stablecoins than Visa.
That sounds absurd, but when you look at the data, it's actually incredible. And I have to be honest, before reading your piece, I actually wasn't aware of that data point, how close we already are to like Visa settlement levels. So really interesting prediction.
Yeah, it's crazy. And really, stablecoins have already surpassed other payment giants like PayPal and MasterCard. So now what we're thinking about doing is, how do we bring that data into this comparison and kind of show like, look, maybe it doesn't hit Visa's level in 2024, but it's already surpassed PayPal. It's already surpassed MasterCard, and it's on its way to surpassing Visa. Another prediction here was that JP Morgan will tokenize a fund and launch it on chain as Wall Street gears up for tokenization of real world assets. Now, I was joking with my boss last week, maybe we should have said BlackRock here. And we would have been able to check this one off, you know, for 2024 already. But maybe JP Morgan will still do it. We've already seen JP Morgan play around with some on-chain things. They haven't tokenized the fund, but they've executed some on-chain trades. And they have this, you know, entire team of hundreds of employees at JP Morgan that are focused on blockchain adoption. And so I don't think it's far-fetched that they'll tokenize a fund and launch it on chain this year, especially now that we've seen BlackRock take that step. Franklin Templeton has already taken that step. I think JP Morgan could be next, despite, you know, Jamie Dimon generally being anti-crypto. Next prediction is that Ethereum revenue will more than double to $5 billion. So Ethereum's revenue, historically speaking, has really boomed in bull markets. That makes sense. More people are using the network. More people are paying fees. More revenue is being generated. We expect that we're in a multi-year bull market, with 2024 being one of those kind of middle to peak years for that activity. And so we expect the revenue will grow from around $2.5 billion, which it was in 2023, to more than $5 billion in 2024.
Current run rate is around $7 billion right now, if you look at like the past 30 days annualized. So good.
There you go. I think their peak was around $9 billion, if I'm not mistaken. It was somewhere between like $7 and $9 billion in 2021. So, you know, even its current run rate may not be its highest yet, but we think that next year in 2025 will be an even stronger year for the performance of crypto and adoption of crypto than 2024 was. And so I think we'll see the peak of this cycle in 2025 or 2026 for Ethereum revenue. But, you know, $7 billion run rates, nothing to balk at, and it definitely gets the attention of investors. Another prediction was that Taylor Swift will launch NFTs to connect with fans in new ways. You know, Taylor Swift is obviously, you know, the most well-known and famous musical artist around the world globally. And when this prediction came out in the middle of the Eras tour, it was in the, you know, the height of the Taylor Swift, Travis Kelce kind of hype. And Taylor also has this history of being very unique in the way she engages with fans and the way that she wants to make her music accessible. And she's kind of a trailblazer when it comes to that. And so it's not far-fetched to think that she might find a way to engage with fans by launching NFTs, whether that's through NFTs that can unlock experiences or it's NFTs that share royalties in her music. We think that it could happen. And, you know, that would unlock a crazy amount of mainstream attention on crypto if someone like Taylor Swift was to launch an NFT collection.
I would buy a Swiftie immediately, especially if it had some kind of royalty share in it, then I'd sweep the floor.
Likewise, I'm right there with you. Another prediction is AI assistants will start to use crypto to pay for things online. So I think this is one that we've seen a lot of people talk about in the past few months. I think Brian Armstrong came on and talked about how he expects, you know, AI agents or AI assistants to start using crypto to pay for services. I think the way to think about this is that as AI grows, you're going to need ways to easily fund like AI agents or AI assistants to carry out kind of remedial tasks. Maybe you need to put down a deposit to hold a reservation at a restaurant, or maybe you need to order some type of gift or a gift card for someone, and you want to outsource that to an AI agent. Someone wants to send gift cards or gift baskets to their clients around the holidays or around a certain life event, then how do you do that? You don't really want to give AI access to your bank account, but maybe you fund a multi-sig with 200 USDC and the AI agent has the ability to draw from that to carry out very specific functions. And so we think that as AI assistants become more and more popular, there's going to be a need for them to, you know, access small amounts of money. And it's really easy to do that with blockchains and with the stable coins. Another prediction, going back to our prediction markets conversation we were having earlier, we think that more than 100 million will be staked in prediction markets, which, you know, could emerge as a killer app for crypto. I believe we're very close to this. When I looked last, I think it was around 95 million for Polymarket alone. And that was just in the first 2 months of the year. And so I think we're definitely going to surpass this one. And as I mentioned earlier, I think with it being an election year and there being continued attention on public opinion around big events, that we're going to see more and more adoption of prediction markets. And it's going to be one of those killer apps of crypto. Two more predictions here. We thought that the major upgrade to the Ethereum blockchain would drive the average transaction costs below 1 cent. That would pave the way for more mainstream users. Now, this was related to EIP 4844 and the Denkun upgrade, which just happened a few weeks ago. And we certainly saw those transactions fall below 1 cent for a short amount of time. Now, they've risen above that in a lot of cases as more activity has surged. But this is a process that we're going to continue to see capacity for blobs grow over time. And so we think that we will eventually get back to that below 1 cent transaction level. But right now we saw that upgrade go through, which is, you know, a really, really exciting upgrade. But right now I think transactions are still above one cent.
Yeah, a big milestone for Ethereum. We'll see how things develop from here, but yeah, pretty close.
Yeah, it's much different than where we were in last bull market in 2021 or 2020 when you were paying, you know, $10, $20, $30, $50 for a transaction on Ethereum mainnet. I know that I minted some NFTs and I go back and look at the fees I paid and I just kind of like want to slap myself because I paid $125 to mint some NFT that's probably now worthless. But now that you can do this on Base, there's all these mints on Zora on Base that are essentially free. I think that paradigm shift unlocks a lot of interesting use cases and allows for a lot more mainstream adoption of these different use cases. And so that's really exciting. And yeah, a major milestone for the Ethereum network. And then the last bonus prediction we put out here was that 1 in 4 financial advisors would allocate to crypto and client accounts by the end of 2024. It's really interesting when you talk to financial advisors, because about half of them have allocated to crypto in their own personal accounts. Like I would say, 50% of advisors have dabbled in Bitcoin on Coinbase or have dabbled into some element of crypto in their personal accounts, but less than 10% are investing on behalf of clients. The reason for that primarily is a lack of access to easily invest for clients. They don't want to take clients' assets and then go buy some Bitcoin on Coinbase. It doesn't fit into their workflow. Maybe their compliance team at their firm doesn't actually allow for that, because that introduces an entire new realm of security concerns and trackability concerns, and it makes reporting more difficult and billing more difficult. And so generally speaking, advisors just have stayed away from it in the past. But with Bitcoin ETFs now launched, we think it's a lot easier, and we've seen that it's a lot easier for investors to allocate to crypto in client accounts within the framework of how they're used to investing and how they're used to running their portfolios. And so we think that we'll see at least 25% of advisors allocating to Bitcoin or crypto more generally in client accounts in 2024. And I think we're definitely seeing that this prediction start to come to fruition with the launch of Bitcoin ETFs.
I would tend to agree. That is a great list of predictions. Thank you for walking us through that. And we're only a fourth of the way into the year and very close to knocking quite a few of them off the list already. So I think that piece is going to age well. Thank you so much for both that and everything that we walked through during the session. Like I said, I'm repeating myself. I'm very glad that we have ambassadors like you and Bitwise between crypto and TradFi onboarding people to the space. Great educators on a great mission. We could probably do a separate episode about every single one of those predictions and every single one of the use cases you're focusing on right now. So maybe we need to make this more of a recurring thing, but I'll cut it for this time. Really appreciate you taking the time to do this, and wish you and the team the best of luck on your mission.
Yeah, thank you so much. We'd love to come back anytime and talk about all things crypto. I appreciate you.